Hello, this is Hector Postigo from culturedigitally.org. I'm a professor at Temple University in the School of Communication and Theater, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to our second episode of Culture Digitally, the podcast. The second episode is part of a series titled Conversations. For this series, we invited scholars who have been writing about issues of cultural production in digital media to think aloud together, reflecting on issues and topics that our readership may find useful to their own work. Today, we are happy to bring you three great young scholars and researchers. Our first guest is Josh Braun. Josh is an assistant professor of interactive media at Quinnipiac University. His research focuses on social media and digital distribution of television news, and his publications have appeared in the journals Communication Theory and Journalism Practice. Our second contributor is Kevin Driscoll. Kevin is a PhD candidate in communication at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California. His research focuses on popular computing cultures and the history of technology. He is the co-founder of the Minitel Research Project at USC and a developer of the YouTube Project at MIT. Lastly, we have Seth Lewis. Seth is an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities, where his research focuses on innovation processes in journalism. He is co-editor of the book The Future of News, An Agenda of Perspectives, and his work has been published in the journals Information Communication in Society and Mass Communication in Society. I'd like to extend a warm welcome to our three guests, and if I could ask them just to go around the room and say their names and institutional affiliations, that way our listeners will be able to identify you when we get the program underway.
I'm Seth Lewis from the University of Minnesota.
I'm Joshua Braun from Quinnipiac University.
This is Kevin Driscoll from University of Southern California.
Great, thank you. Today's topic will focus on epistemology and expertise. So we've had this discussion before, and one of the things that we were thinking about was the division between the two, one being considered a technical practice, expertise, and the other, a way of knowing, almost a philosophical approach. I'm wondering if you three would be willing to discuss if that's an accurate characterization of the two concepts and how they may be coming together, and what the implications are of those characterizations for research on culture and digital media. So I guess we could start with Josh. Josh, lead us off, please.
So one of the things that I love is Karen Norsatina's approach to this, and she originally was looking not so much at our sort of media culture, but at science and technology. And what she sort of looked at was to say that basically when you have different researchers, for instance, and science being kind of a form of knowledge or a way of knowing, who are looking at different problems, you know, some are studying microorganisms, others are studying sort of large questions in physics or microphysics and things of this nature. What you have are not just different topics of inquiry, you actually have different cultures of inquiry. So people have this thing that they're sort of fiddling with and asking questions of, sort of teasing apart the different pieces of a microorganism or something like that. And the sort of the thing that they're working on actually becomes a sort of culture surrounding their interactions with that physical object. And it becomes sort of a culture and a way of knowing. And so one of the things that she suggests that's really compelling is that this is no longer sort of the reserve of institutional forms of knowledge, but that our culture is now sort of shot through with these epistemic cultures, as she calls them, that all of us, when we're figuring out our little gadgets or trying to fix our computers or just on a day-to-day basis, sort of like working with technical objects, are actually becoming part of these sort of, we're becoming enculturated into these different ways of knowing about our world that are partly about this sort of dealing with material agency and the gadgets and the sort of different media in our lives. So I love that observation. I just wanted to throw that out there.
So I'm actually going to get this started maybe with a question that I think would be good for us to sort of tease out together as a group. And the first question might be, why historically have epistemology and expertise been considered separate? And why might this moment now be different in that we can see them coming together in some fashion? That would be, I think, something for us to tease out. And also, I mean, are we thinking about expertise and epistemology in the same kinds of ways? I mean, those concepts can be approached from different vantage points, which then yield different kinds of results, or at least different ways of thinking about the world. And so I think that it's sort of important to kind of think about, take a step back and say, well, what do we mean by expertise? What do we mean by epistemology? So maybe I'm taking the easy way out, but I'm posing questions to begin with.
One way of thinking into expertise for me is thinking about the identity position of the expert, and that expertise seems like something we're saying is that expertise is linked to practice and is something that is based in action. That expertise is something that has to be carried out, or it's demonstrable in some sort of way, and that there's going to be a culture or some other sort of context in which a person can step forward or step into the role, the position of the expert, and then almost prove it or prove their expertise through some sort of action. And that in some contexts, there may be like a certification process that allows them to skip over that moment of demonstration. But that seems to be, for me, the key opening into ways of parsing out this epistemology and expertise, is that moment of practice, demonstration, proof. And for programmers, that comes in the form of like, my code compiled, it ran. For somebody who's an expert in working with cars, it's like the car wasn't driving and now it's on the road and it's going. There's some kind of like proof that is outside of argument, outside of discourse, or believed to be outside.
I like the the observation that it's believed to be outside of something. The way that that our artifacts can have sort of politics, or that they can have ideals or prejudices built into them about what it takes to get something working. What makes sense in a programming language or something like that, whether it's object oriented or procedural or something like that. Can you say more about that sort of can you get outside of argument, really, or does the argument just become somehow implicit or tacit in the way that people worry about when they talk about the politics of artifacts?
I keep going back to an edge case, I think, which is ham radio, and especially like Chris Herring's book about ham radio, that she describes it as a technical culture. And she talks about it as like a sort of a popular culture activity where a technical object is the focal point of the center, is like exploring inside of that thing all of the bounds. And so the people are creating expertise, but the subject position is still the hobbyist. And it isn't until the knowledge that's generated inside the technical culture is carried into a new context that they can be recognized as kind of an expert in some way. And so, I don't know, there's something about that migration of skills and practices that only sometimes is it necessary to translate them into discourse, possibly, and that in other contexts, merely the fact of some object doing something or being able to take a certain role in a situation is enough in order for the expert to be like securely in that position. I'm not sure that answers your question as so much as it clouds it a little bit.
No, I think I'm reminded that there were, you know, sort of debates about what the logic of computers, now that you actually have a machine, like an embodied object that works on sort of Boolean logic. Does that prove something about like sort of about the truth claims of, you know, sort of like these Boolean or Cartesian knowledge claims and that type of thing? It's a really interesting question. I doubt we'll answer it here, but I love it.
Okay, so if I can kind of throw in an example or a kind of current issue maybe that would allow us to try to approach this and I don't know, less of an abstract level and get down to kind of a tangible always thing that we can try to analyze together. Okay, so let's take the current movement right now, if you will, toward learning how to program, right? Mayor Bloomberg says his goal this year was to learn to program. You've got Code Academy, which has been, received lots of attention for encouraging people to learn how to code. Douglas Rushkoff's program or be programmed theme, right? So what can we learn about expertise and epistemology and the fusion of these two concepts in looking at this, well, maybe we can call it a movement or phenomenon or whatever, of people feeling that they need to learn how to code in order to, I mean, there's this embedded assumption that if you do not learn how to code, you therefore are falling, you're going to fall behind and be left behind. And that something, not only expertise, but almost like you're somehow then, you're missing out on even something larger within our social world, mm-hmm. that you're no longer as valued or as valuable if you do not have that particular skill set. And I think this is, and I'm interested in this question because I'm, you know, studying hackers and journalists and looking at the intersection that's there in spaces like Hacks Hackers and others, where they come to these meetings with different sets of expertise, and generally it has to do with coding expertise or narrative storytelling expertise, and, you know, looking at how they interact and how they value the other's skill set and so forth. But again, to get back to this kind of phenomenon, I mean, what do you think about, you know, what do you think this represents? I mean, do you get any ideas about epistemology or expertise when we talk about this particular case?
I'm struck by the sort of echoes of the feminist movement, right? Where there was this idea that, you know, that women should learn skills that had been culturally male, right? Learn to fix your car, learn to sort of do construction on your house and that type of thing. Because, you know, the idea being that you would be, it was sort of the, like, you know, the, a different but sort of resonant version of this notion of, like, you know, program or be programmed, right? If you want to escape the power structures that had confined women to particular jobs and positions in society and that type of thing, that you needed to take on and master the skills that had been sort of culturally denied to women up to that point. So it's interesting. I mean, it seems like we have those debates in society, like, periodically. I think it's a really interesting idea.
For a concrete example of the programming question, and I have a couple thoughts about the programming question, so I'll start with an example and we can work backwards from it, is that earlier we were talking about the problem in archiving YouTube videos, and that the links eventually die. Users take the videos down voluntarily, or videos come down because of copyright. And depending on how you are engaging with the software system of YouTube, you get different answers. So if you, you know, enter the URL or click on a link into the browser, you may or may not get a certain amount of information in the error message that appears on the screen. Hmm. But if you request the same video through the search API, you get a different object back that often includes a little bit more detail. For example, in a copyright takedown, it often tells you the person, the name of the entity that requested the takedown. So there, if you have enough of the programming ability to like engage with the API instead of the search bar or the URL, then you literally get access to new information. Mm-hmm. But if you enter into, say, CodeYear or Codecademy or just get the beginning programming book, it's not getting you up to speed to that place. And so a lot of times programming education is based on fundamental principles, because you really need those fundamental principles, the logic, variables, and eventually kind of like objects and classes and things like that, in order to read the documents that'll tell you the things that you want to do, like mm-hmm. to be able to speak to the API. And it's very frustrating, I think, from a scholarship point of view, because mm-hmm. scholars are not really trying to get to those fundamental pieces. And the line of code that would be required to see that extra information is one line. Mm-hmm. But there's so much built into that one line that sometimes people don't, they get stymied, or they kind of fall to the wayside before they get there. So it's interesting to think about, like, a Mayer Bloomberg figure as a code learner, and how he enters into that field. Is he, like, what's the code that he's learning? Where is it? Once he gets out of those very first few steps of, like, A equals 3, and then A is a variable, you know, where is, like, step 4 or 5 down that road?
And why the heck is he learning how to code? I mean, seriously, like, that. I mean, it kind of raises this question of, like, why would that be considered so important that someone who clearly shouldn't be learning how to code feels that he needs to learn how to code? In other words, that would be a better use of his time mm-hmm. than what he should probably be doing on behalf of the city, right? That kind of attention, anyway.
No, I mean, I think that's a great sort of point and a great example, and it reminds me of, you know, many of the stories. You know, I think there was even like a URL at one point that somebody, or a website that somebody put up with why I learned to code, where people would just submit a one sentence explanation or something like that. And frequently, the stories you would see on that site, and the stories that you hear from programmers and people who have picked it up as a hobby or a profession, are that I learned because I wanted to do X, right? I wanted to accomplish this, you know. So there wasn't software out there that was written that would do this. I wanted my website to do this type of thing, or I wanted to build an application that would solve this problem. And so they learn with very concrete objectives in mind, which is, again, sort of an interesting question about this sort of about power differentials and the value, like the sort of value-laden nature of technology, because people are learning to accomplish specific objectives. And so it gets to that sort of this idea of sort of, again, like sort of the politics of artifacts, whether like which comes first, the social influence or the technological influence, and where did those things get built in? And so I really like the question, the example.
So to come back to Hector's question, you know, one of the thoughts I had is that, all right, so let's think about the ways that researchers traditionally have tried to assess the world, right? Mm-hmm. Examine rhetoric, texts, social interactions, maybe they look at networks, institutions, and so forth. Well, to what extent, to kind of continue with the code sort of discussion here, I mean, to the extent that our life, and as you know, Mark Doise would say, you know, is becoming more of a media life. So much of our life is not separate from offline and online, but that so much of our, you know, our self is communicated through algorithms and technological systems. Then, to what extent does a knowledge of code, in order to deconstruct the code necessary to do research in this era? In other words, if deconstructing text was important for rhetoricians, then how is deconstructing code and algorithms going to be essential for researchers in the future? Which again gets back to this needing, learning how to code. And I think that it's interesting to kind of think about, in other words, kind of what is knowledge about the world? How is that different, mm-hmm. Different perhaps or not in kind of offline versus online kinds of contexts, digital, non-digital? And to the extent that you need to get under the hood to really understand something like APIs and Google and Facebook, mm-hmm. and so forth, to be able to critique them appropriately, I think it's a really interesting question for research.
Yeah, no, I love that. I'm reminded of when you talk about sort of what constitutes sort of knowledge, what constitutes a system of knowledge, I know your field is journalism studies, so I can use the journalism example, which is Gay Tuckman in Making News, her famous sort of ethnography, talked about, encouraged us to consider news as a system of knowledge, among other institutional systems of knowledge. She has the nice sort of final chapter where she says, like, you know, and sociology is a system of knowledge, and science is a system of knowledge, and these other things are as well. I've always thought it was quite brilliant the way that she lays out sort of the way that news is a system of knowledge, where you have sort of a system in place for gathering information, right? So the AP news wires or stringers who are out in like the suburbs and that type of thing, gathering stories for you. And so she crafts this picture of what she calls the news net, which is not just the network of individuals and resources, but also sort of meant to conjure up this image of a net, like lifting certain things of only certain size and shape out of the water, right? So the news net, the news system of knowledge, captures only particular events, only particular things. And it was this sort of big comment at the time, one of the seminal comments on news as sort of a socially constructed system of knowledge. That and her other concept from that book that I love is the web of facticity, this idea that sort of a bunch of that the way that a story is written, a news story is written, different facts back each other up in such and such a way, the result of which is a story that where any one fact is contestable, but the whole account seems true. Right, so you have this sort of distribution of physical and personnel resources, and this sort of and this kind of nomenclature, this system for putting together symbols and so on and so forth, that together constitute the system of knowledge. And the reason that I'm taken in by Nor Sutina is it seems like that she's kind of extended this to, we have many different sort of systems of knowledge out there. So now that we're in this problem with news, of sort of, we used to be worried, journalists that used to be worried about sort of, sort of interest groups used to be worried about how to get journalists to spread their messages. And now in the world age of social distribution and Twitter and that type of thing, journalists are concerned about how to get non-journalists to spread their messages. And I think that sort of the aspect of that that's interesting is that you have a bunch of different systems of knowledge, different online communities, different people who sort of have different standards and different networks for taking in information, different standards for what constitutes interesting or good or valid information, and all of these are coexisting in the same kind of place. And so, you know, getting back to sort of the example of research and that type of thing, I think it's an interesting question to ask and put in those terms is sort of, what is research? What is sociological? What is communication research as a system of knowledge? Sort of where, how do we distribute our resources? What constitutes sort of valid knowledge? What is the web of facticity when it comes to something like code? Do you need to understand the nuts and bolts? Is that a valid place to put sort of resources and personnel and everything else in training graduate students to learn programming and that type of thing, or taking in graduate students from computer science programs and that type of thing? Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting question that cuts really to the core of a lot of these things. But that's me rambling, so I'll cut it off.
I mean, the ramble is really interesting because it asks us, would the scholars be, do we consider the scholars experts? Do the scholars consider themselves experts? And so, and to what extent is this issue of teaching code or purposefully seeking colleagues or candidates who can code, is that a challenge, or is that revealing something about the instability of expertise in that professional sphere?
Yeah, I love your example, Kevin, that you may have thrown this out as just as a simple thing, but you talked about sort of that sharing knowledge is between expertise is like building an interface, right? Building an interface to a different community and so forth. I'm wondering, because I think you can partially answer the question you posed there with that. I thought that was a brilliant observation. If you recall enough of it to rehash it here.
If I were to answer my own question, I would answer it differently.
Okay, then.
But in a related way, which is, I think that expertise seems more stable from outside. Mm-hmm. So from inside the place of I would consider myself a programmer, mm-hmm. but my ability to represent myself as a programmer is constantly being challenged as I move to new domains. So in my life, I've hardly ever done programming that involves graphics. So if I am thrown into a conversation with people, that's the main work that they do, I know nothing about it. I know the very basic things about, you know, I can understand that if they talk through it, I kind of understand the terms and things that they're using, but I would be lost if I was asked to collaborate with them on a project. Mm-hmm. Likewise, if they were invited to be the representative programmer in a communication department, they don't really have the skills that would be helpful to scholars in that way. And so when we talk about like learning to code, it seems like so simple as a concept. And that Bloomberg thing is key too. Like what would a programmer mayor know how to do? My guess is not make video games. it wouldn't be like making iPhone 3D models or something like that. But it might be something else. I'm not even sure exactly what it... I don't know yet what that would be. But so from the outside point of view, it's like at some point you become able to code. And it seems simplistic to compare it to other types of language, but there isn't really, where is the point where you couldn't speak English and now you can speak English? Mm-hmm. You know, from the, there's mm-hmm. constantly the finish line is like moving as you get closer to it. And you definitely do reach a point where you reflect on how far you've come and you're able to see, okay, yeah, I guess I speak English now. Like you feel confident enough to say that. And I was thinking of the jargon file, which I don't understand exactly who the author is, but the maintainer is Eric Raymond. And there's a part about how to become a hacker. Mm-hmm. And he says that you know you're a hacker when another hacker calls you a hacker, which is like the ultimate in instability that you never know when you're there.
Is the point you asked what a programmer mayor could do? I mean, does he become a more Does he become a better manager of the sort of information technicians of which he is increasingly having to interface, for instance? You know, I mean, of the, because I mean, he's going to like, as cities and all sorts of systems become more dependent on algorithms and programs and that type of thing. I mean, does it make him better able to interface with the people who do need to do that kind of stuff? Is there a value in it that way?
Yeah, I mean, maybe we're mapping out two separate things. There's the programmer mayor who makes things and does programming in the course of like his or her work. Mm-hmm. And then there's like the mayor who can participate or who has developed like an epistemology that is encompassing of programmer knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so that's maybe where the ambiguity of expertise becomes useful. It's like, how much code do you need to do in order to be able to know a code-driven world? From when I was teaching high school students about programming, it seemed like a big turning point is when something broke and they could like think maybe about why it broke instead of attributing it to like their own error.
Mm.
You know, that, oh, I know how this ought to work because I did something else. They don't know how to fix this. They don't know how to like make Facebook or make Quake 3 or something like that. They just made their own little programs, but they like got enough there to be able to like think inside of those other systems.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a form of expertise? It definitely has an epistemological dimension to it, but where would a person like that be like recognized as an expert?
Okay, I actually don't know if this will be answering anyone's question, maybe just posing new ones, but let me see if I can take this a slightly different direction, you know, get away just from coding. I mean, another example, I think, and I say this as someone who admittedly has an MBA, but I don't know that I'm all that much better for it, but no offense to my alma mater. But I think about like the MBA, like what does the MBA know? Right? What does that person know? And what do they know in relation to the accountants and the, you know, the financial analysts, the marketing experts and others within their firm. I mean, the MBA is structured such that you gain just enough expertise in each of those domains so that as a manager, you can know when your subordinates are trying to fool you. so you have just enough knowledge, just enough kind of, you know, relevant expertise and terminology and language within those subfields. Just like maybe the programmer mayor would have know just enough to recognize that there might be a better way to approach the technology systems of New York City. And so I think that the reason I bring this up is I think trying to expand this out beyond coding, you know, we look at other, just social institutions and groups and whether online or offline, all kinds, you know, to think about what do people know? And then I think the follow-up question to that would be, why are certain forms of knowledge and expertise and so forth of particular value in society today? I mean, when we think about kind of the market logic that seems to sort of be over and above all else, right? So how are certain forms of knowledge and expertise associated with larger, you know, market-based systems or, you know, democratic political institutions? I mean, for instance, this emphasis on coding, you know, the fact that it dovetails with the concurrent rise of Silicon Valley and Facebook IPO and all this kinds of stuff. How might that be different in the United States context relative to other countries where they don't maybe have such an emphasis on that type of market structure? I'm posing a new question, but I think that would sort of be my exit point would be to say that I think it's interesting as we go forward as researchers to consider, you know, the interplay of expertise and epistemology within larger structures and forces and within kind of a network of other outside influences.
Mm-hmm. I think that takes it back to Kevin's point to a bit, right? Because the market logic, right? This idea of market clearing, right? If all the prices are set just right, like, you know, everybody gets what they want and everybody's happy, or at least has like sort of the maximum number of hedons assignable, you know? And so, and that is sort of, that is this knowledge, this idea of something that's like sort of external to argument, right? That's sort of, I think maybe that's one of the reasons that at least within the sort of rhetorical framework of, you know, sort of Western capitalism, like the market is an appeal to a higher authority because it's somehow outside of logic. You know, people are buying it, it's working, you know, and so on and so forth. There is market efficiency there. And so that may be, so, you know, when looking for the values inside the machine, I think that that's kind of an interesting place. That's an interesting as interesting place to look as any. Although I sound like a Marxist when I say that, but I mean, and the same thing is true with, like, you know, with Twitter or Facebook. It's like people are using it, right? There's all these analytics, you know, that are really attractive to marketers and advertisers and everybody else, because they can see all these page impressions, and they may not know exactly how they're valuable, but there's this idea that, like, the numbers are there and somehow they'll work themselves out.
Well, maybe just to build on that a little bit, kind of, again, thinking about, you know, how are certain forms of expertise associated with the derivatives of computational processes, right? Algorithms and others, you know, analytics and so forth. So, and then how are they associated with market types of forces and dynamics? In other words, why is everybody learning how to code and not spending a lot of time learning Shakespeare in new ways, right? I mean, like, we don't see people out there saying, wow, this is the year that I've got to learn. I've got to really be more about the humanities. And I think we can kind of understand that it's because we're in a very kind of jobs-oriented environment, et cetera, et cetera. But I still think that it's important to kind of think about expertise in that bit of a broader context.
One part of the expertise conversation that we haven't touched on as much that I think is relevant to your last two, this last exchange, is about certification and ways of expertise being recognized by people outside of a certain domain. And I've been thinking a lot about these types of certifications that that can work for and against an individual depending on the context that they're in. And so an example of that layer of certification would be like going to ITT Tech or being a member of the Best Buy Geek Squad, mm-hmm. or working at the Genius Bar at Apple or something like that. Those certifications put you into a new employable place on one hand, and they definitely represent expertise in a certain way, but they absolutely would work against you if you were applying to a job at, say, Facebook, because it suggests something about you. And if you instead had zero credentials from institutional tech credentials, but you had like an amazing GitHub profile and you had all these like likes or whatever on Stack Overflow, then. Yeah. Yeah, then that's like a different type of expertise. Mm-hmm. And I wonder about like how those might collide, and if there are people out there with multiple resumes where like one resume has their Microsoft Developer Network certifications on it, and then their other one has like is highlighting their contributions to open source software, or if those are separate populations of technical experts who aren't really coming into contact much in either like fun and like leisurely type of like non-professional environments, and in their professional lives.
Yeah. I know that like the Mozilla Foundation and people like Alex Halliday are trying to create like a badge system for like sort of certification, and I know that, like, you know, sort of, and I think that'll be a really interesting question to see how like they handle that, is sort of like, you know, how to turn these things into stuff that's recognized in a lot of different places.
Yeah, I know we're kind of coming close, but I really liked Henry Jenkins' response to the badging controversy that was playing out, where he was talking about expertise that is developed outside of a traditional professional institutions, and how badging can kind of like mess with some of the ways that people have already parceled out certain things in their lives, and that it may actually work against ways that epistemologies are developed socially and collectively in non-professional environments, in ways that like rupture the very conditions that led to their development in the first place.
Okay, if I can maybe wind us down a little bit. This has been a great discussion. Thank you very much, Kevin, Josh, Seth, for coming out and having a conversation for our listeners. And we hope to hear more from you, obviously, and to read more of your work. Thanks very much. Culture Digitally, the podcast, is a production of culturedigitally.org. This is on the web at www.culturedigitally.org. That's www.culturedigitally.org. The project is made possible through the generous support of the National Science Foundation. It's managed by myself, Hector Postigo from Temple University, and Tarleton Gillespie from Cornell University. Tune in again soon for our next installment of Conversations on Culture Digitally, the podcast. Thanks for listening.